Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier. It's Friday, September 3rd. I'm your reader, Bob Young. The Courier is forecasting a morning of thunderstorms with winds west-southwest from 8 to 16 miles per hour. We'll have a high of 70 degrees. Tonight, our low will be 62 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Looking around the region, a thunderstorm in the morning, otherwise rather cloudy today, mostly cloudy tonight. Pleasant tomorrow with intervals of clouds and sunshine. Sunday will be mostly sunny and nice. The sun rose this morning at 6:37 a.m. and sets tonight at 8:38 a.m. We will have a new moon on Monday, September 6th. The Courier is featuring these stories on the front page. The fight of his life. Biden blasts courts in action. Iowa Democrats' hopeful GOP redistricting stays nonpartisan. And we begin with Reynolds holds firm on COVID mask ban. Reynolds repeats call for vaccinations, but makes no COVID policy changes. Story filed by Aaron Murphy and begins with a photograph of our governor speaking at a microphone. Des Moines. Governor Kim Reynolds on Thursday called on Iowans to get vaccinated to limit the spread of COVID-19, but she announced no policy changes and defended a new state law that prevents schools from requiring students to wear face masks. Quote, "It's obvious that vaccines are our best tool against countering COVID-19, Reynolds said, during a news conference at the Iowa Capitol. Quote, "So, we want to reiterate to Iowans to get the information that you need to research and get a vaccine. It's the best thing that you can do to protect yourself and your loved ones. We see that the data we're collecting actually proves that out," unquote. After months of decline following a winter spike, COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations are once again surging in Iowa. Numbers in Iowa and nationwide are higher than they have been since January, the tail end of the pandemic's deadliest stretch. Iowa is averaging nearly 1,500 new cases per day, 15 times the rate just 2 months ago, and 524 people are hospitalized for COVID-19, more than 7 times as many as just 2 months ago. Another troubling development, more than 40% of new cases in Iowa are among children and people in their 20s, according to data released Wednesday. Among those currently hospitalized for COVID-19 in Iowa, 5% are younger than 18. The state, which currently updates its data only once a week, reported an additional 8,907 new cases and 29 additional deaths to bring the state's total to 6,307. The 7-day rolling average of cases has been gradually increasing since early June and is now at 8,225 cases per week. The data show that 22% of the positive tests in the last week were among children 17 and younger, and 20% of positives were among those in their late teens and 20s. Some northern Iowa counties with high positivity rates are reporting more than 1/3 of their new positive cases are among children under 17. In Crawford County, 44% of the cases in the past week were among that age group, and in Floyd County, it was 40%. In Story County, the home of Iowa State University, 40% of new COVID-19 cases were reported among the 18 to 29 age group. The state also reported outbreaks of COVID-19 in 16 long-term facilities, double the number just a week ago. Two main factors are driving this latest upsurge. The Delta variant, which spreads faster than the virus's original strain, and the unvaccinated. The Delta variant accounts for 99% of all new cases, Reynolds said Thursday. Quote, "With the availability of vaccines, the rise we're currently experiencing isn't cause for panic. Far from it. But it's a good reason to consider what you can do to help," Reynolds said. "And what Iowans can do first and foremost, Reynolds said, is to get the vaccine. According to state data, 4 out of 5 current COVID-19 patients in hospitals are unvaccinated, as are 9 out of 10 patients in intensive care. Nearly 64% of Iowans age 18 and older are fully vaccinated, and 66.4% of Iowans ages 12 and older, those who are eligible to get the vaccines, have received at least one shot, according to state data. Quote, the data reflect, as you've heard for months now, that COVID-19 vaccines are highly effective at preventing serious illness, hospitalizations, and deaths, which ensures that more beds are available for other purposes, Reynolds said. But aside from continuing her call for Iowans to get vaccinated, Reynolds announced no new policy changes. She said the virus likely is here to stay and that the pandemic will become an epidemic, one that must constantly be managed in a responsible and balanced way, unquote. Reynolds, a Republican, defended the new state law, which she approved after it was passed by Republicans in the Iowa legislature, that prohibits schools from requiring students or staff to wear face masks. The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends all school staff and students wear face masks. On Monday, the U.S. Education Department announced it's investigating Iowa and 4 other states that prohibit school mask mandates on grounds the bans discriminate against students with health conditions and disabilities. Most Iowa school districts started the 2021-2022 school year the week of August 23rd. Quote, I believe the government's role in a public health crisis is to provide the public reliable information so that they can make their own informed decisions, Reynolds said. I also believe this approach is more effective than mandates that attempt to dictate other people's behavior, unquote. When asked by reporters, Kelly Garcia, interim state public health director, said her children wear face masks to school. Quote, I'm not going to disclose our own family's reasons as to why, but we have some reasons as to why. And I don't want my kids to be sick, and I can't afford them to bring that home, said Garcia, who is vaccinated. State Senator Minority Leader Zach Walls, a Democrat from Coralville, issued a statement Thursday saying Reynolds and her fellow State House Republicans own the most recent COVID surge because of their inaction. Quote, COVID isn't going away because Kim Reynolds and Iowa Republicans aren't doing anything to make it go away, Walls said. Quote, our return to normal continues to be pushed further and further into the future because Republicans continue to fail to do anything to stop the spread of the Delta variant, unquote. Garcia announced the public health department will begin updating some COVID-19 data 3 times per week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. In July, the department transitioned from updating the data multiple times daily to just once per week. A public health department official said the reduction in updates was necessary to give staff time to analyze and ensure the data's accuracy. In the next story, filed by Craig Sesker, young Waverly athlete Charlie Kramer rebounding from devastating stroke. Waverly, the call was placed while most of us were sleeping. It was just after 1 a.m. August 20th when Kaula Kramer frantically called Waterloo's Unity Point Health Allen Hospital. She couldn't believe what she was seeing, and medical personnel couldn't believe what they were hearing. Quote, my son just had a stroke, Kaula Kramer said. When Kaula made the call, she and her husband already were en route to the hospital with their son. They raced south on U.S. 218 as 14-year-old Charlie fought for his life. They weren't at Allen Hospital for long. Shortly after arriving in Waterloo, Charlie was placed in an ambulance and rushed to University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. They arrived around 4:30 a.m. Time was of the essence, and doctors needed to work quickly. Fortunately for the Kramers, they landed in one of the best hospitals in the world. Doctors were able to provide the specialized care that the Waverly Shell Rock freshman needed. Quote, they basically saved his life, Kaula said. Doctors determined Charlie had multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children, or MISC. Charlie tested positive for antibodies for COVID-19, and the doctor said this was an after effect of the virus. News of Charlie's condition sent shockwaves through the tight-knit Waverly Shell Rock community. Quote, "Charlie's one of those kids that does everything right," said Greg Stockdale, whose son plays football alongside Charlie for WSR. "It makes you wonder why things like this happen to kids like him," unquote. It's been 2 weeks now since Charlie suffered the stroke, and slowly and steadily, he is on the road to recovery. After 9 days at university hospitals, Charlie was transferred to Mercy One in Waterloo. The love and support shown by the Waverly Shell Rock community has been impressive and widespread. During his stay at university hospitals, Iowa Hawkeye players signed a football with the words, "Wishing you the best, Charlie." That was presented to him. He also received a large number of cards and flowers during his stay in Iowa City. Charlie Kramer's Waverly Shell Rock teammates were wearing stickers with his initials, CK, on the back of their helmets. There have been a large number of messages and well wishes on Facebook and other social media outlets for Charlie and his family. Before he suffered a stroke, Charlie had been dealing with numerous medical issues after being injured during a football practice at Waverly Shell Rock. He was involved in a helmet-to-helmet collision with a teammate August 13th and eventually was diagnosed with a concussion. For the next week, Charlie battled numerous medical issues. He had a low-grade fever, his eyes were bloodshot, and he had a stiff neck. He also experienced dizziness and blurred vision. The Kramers took Charlie to hospitals in Waterloo and Waverly that week. They even had him checked out at a local eye doctor. But no one was able to pinpoint what exactly was going on with Charlie. Then, just after midnight August 20th, his condition worsened considerably. Carla walked into Charlie's room at 1 a.m. to give him some Tylenol. Quote, "I tried talking to him and he couldn't understand what I was saying," Carla said. "His right arm was numb and limp, and he had zero movement in his hand. He showed all of the signs of someone who had just had a stroke," unquote. Carla quickly alerted her husband, and they decided to immediately take Charlie to nearby Allen Hospital. Quote, "They ran tests and found that he had a blood clot on his heart," Carla said. "He had inflammation of the heart, and they tried to get it under control. His heart wasn't functioning properly because of the blood clot that had formed," unquote. It is believed Charlie had contracted COVID sometime before he was injured during the football practice. The impact of COVID likely contributed to the medical issues he encountered. Quote, "It was a nightmare when he had his stroke. It was just very, very scary," Carla said. "I remember trying to stay calm in front of Charlie, but you're running through so many different emotions when something like this happens to your child. Thank God we were able to make it to the hospitals in time," unquote. During Charlie's 9 days in Iowa City, his condition improved considerably. Quote, "His inflammation numbers went down," Carla said. "It was amazing what they did at university hospitals. Their care was outstanding. They did an incredible job," unquote. Charlie improved enough to be moved to Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center earlier this week. His condition continues to improve, but he's still facing his share of hurdles on the road to recovery. He's not yet able to speak, and he hasn't regained use of his right arm. Quote, "He can't talk, but he's very responsive," Carla said. "He understands everything that you're saying. We downloaded an app, and he is able to type a message on there if he needs something. He can write with his left hand, but he's right-handed. His right arm is still damaged from the stroke," unquote. Charlie's prognosis is promising. Quote, "The doctors are very hopeful and positive that he can make a full recovery," Carla said. "He's not out of the woods yet with the blood clot on his heart. He's on blood thinners, and they are watching him closely. His movement and speech are expected to return. They can't give a full timeline on when that will happen, but we're encouraged that he will continue to get better," unquote. Waverly Shell Rock head football coach Mark Hubbard knows Charlie Kramer well. Hubbard's son, Wesley, is a classmate and teammate of Charlie's at WSR. Quote, Charlie is a gritty competitor and as hard a worker as you will find, Coach Hubbard said. Quote, those are attributes that will definitely be in his favor during his rehabilitation, unquote. Hubbard said he wasn't surprised at the amount of support Charlie has received. Quote, the outpouring from the Waverly-Shell Rock community has been phenomenal, Hubbard said. Quote, the Kramers have given so much to so many people. They are really connected to our school. It's been pretty impressive to see the towns of Waverly and Shell Rock get behind them. The Kramers have relied on their faith as a source of strength, and I'm confident that they will continue to do that. It really is a great family, unquote. Through it all, the Kramer family has relied on their strong bond to persevere through Charlie's unthinkable circumstances. Calla and her husband Steve have 7 children. Quote, our family is very close, and we're so blessed to have such amazing children, Calla said. Quote, everyone has provided so much support for Charlie during all of this, unquote. Calla and Steve Kramer were able to find time to attend son Camden's first football game of the season this past Monday. Charlie's older brother, Cole, stayed with Charlie for a few hours to allow that to happen. It was a game Charlie had fully expected to play in when he started practice just a few weeks ago. He and Camden are twins and teammates on the Go Hawk freshman team. Charlie wasn't there in person at Monday's game, but his teammates and family certainly felt his presence, and the CK helmet stickers provided added inspiration. Quote, I know Charlie would have loved to have been out there playing football with his friends and teammates, Calla said. I'm sure his buddies were thinking about Charlie. We can't thank everyone enough for reaching out and praying for us during this difficult time. It means everything to our family. The community support has been phenomenal. Quote, we are very grateful that Charlie is still alive. God has taken care of us and really answered all of our prayers, unquote. Next, Biden blasts high court over abortion ruling. Stories filed by Jessica Gresko of the Associated Press and begins with a photograph of the president speaking behind a podium. Washington. President Joe Biden on Thursday blasted the Supreme Court's decision not to block a new Texas law banning most abortions in the state and directed federal agencies to do what they can to insulate women and providers from the impact. Hours earlier, in the middle of the night, a deeply divided high court allowed the law to remain in force. It is the nation's biggest curb to abortion rights since the court announced its landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that women have a constitutional right to abortion. The court voted 5-4 to deny an emergency appeal from abortion providers and others, but also suggested that their order wasn't likely the last word and other challenges can be brought. Biden said in a statement that his administration will launch a whole-of-government effort to respond to this decision, unquote, and look at what steps the federal government can take to ensure that women in Texas have access to safe and legal abortions as protected by Roe, unquote. Attorney General Merrick Garland said in a statement that the Justice Department was deeply concerned about the Texas law and evaluating all options to protect the constitutional rights of women, including access to an abortion, unquote. Biden, who has come under pressure from Democrats to expand the size of the Supreme Court, has ordered a review of the court that is due next month. The Texas law, signed by Republican Governor Greg Abbott in May, prohibits abortions once medical professionals can detect cardiac activity, usually around 6 weeks, and before many women even know they're pregnant. The law is part of a broader push by Republicans nationwide to impose new restrictions on abortion. At least 12 other states have enacted bans early in pregnancy, but all have been blocked from going into effect. The High Court's order declining to halt the Texas law came just before midnight on Wednesday. The majority said those bringing the case had not met the high burden required for a stay of the law. Quote, in reaching this conclusion, we stress that we do not purport to resolve definitively any jurisdictional or substantive claim in the applicant's lawsuit. In particular, this order is not based on any conclusion about the constitutionality of the Texas law, and in no way limits other procedurally proper challenges to the Texas law, including in Texas state courts, the unsigned order said. Chief Justice John Roberts dissented along with the court's three liberal justices. Each of the four wrote a statement expressing disagreement with the majority. Roberts noted that while the majority denied the request for emergency relief, the court's order is emphatic in making clear that it cannot be understood as sustaining the constitutionality of the law at issue. Separately, the justices are planning to tackle the issue in a major case when they begin hearing arguments again in the fall. That case involves the state of Mississippi, which is asking to be allowed to enforce an abortion ban after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The vote in the Texas case underscores the impact of the death of liberal Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg last year, and then-President Donald Trump's replacement of her with conservative Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Had Ginsburg remained in the court, there would have been 5 votes to halt the Texas law. Justice Sonia Sotomayor called her conservative colleague's decision stunning. Quote, presented with an application to enjoin a flagrantly unconstitutional law engineered to prohibit women from exercising their constitutional rights and evade judicial scrutiny, a majority of justices have opted to bury their heads in the sand, she wrote. Texas lawmakers wrote the law to evade federal court review by allowing private citizens to bring lawsuits in state court against anyone involved in an abortion other than the patient. Other abortion laws are enforced by state and local officials with criminal sanctions possible. In contrast, Texas's law allows private citizens to sue abortion providers and anyone involved in facilitating abortions, among other situations. That could include anyone who drives a woman to a clinic to get an abortion. Under the law, anyone who successfully sues another person would be entitled to at least $10,000. Justice Elena Kagan wrote that the law was patently unconstitutional, and Justice Stephen Breyer said a woman has a federal constitutional right to obtain an abortion during the first stage of pregnancy. However, anti-abortion groups cheered the court's action. Quote, this is the most significant accomplishment for the pro-life movement in Texas since Roe v. Wade, said John Sago, legislative director for Texas Right to Life, the state's largest anti-abortion group. Quote, we had the Supreme Court that is allowing the strongest bill we've ever passed to go into effect, and that is unheard of, unquote. Kristen Hawkins, the president of Students for Life of America, said in a statement that her group was celebrating this decision for what is baby steps in the right direction toward the obvious conclusion that Roe is fatally flawed and must go, unquote. But Nancy Northrup, the head of the Center for Reproductive Rights, which represents abortion providers challenging the law, vowed to keep fighting it. Quote, right now, people seeking abortion across Texas are panicking. They have no idea where or when they will be able to get an abortion, if ever, she said. Texas has long had some of the nation's toughest abortion restrictions, including a sweeping law passed in 2013. The Supreme Court eventually struck down that law, but not before more than half of the state's 40-plus clinics had closed. James Lynch filed this next story. Iowa Democrats hopeful GOP redistricting stays nonpartisan. First set of new maps to be released September 16th. Iowa Democratic leaders are hopeful and cautiously optimistic that Iowa will maintain its tradition of redrawing legislative and congressional lines in a nonpartisan fashion. Quote, it's not Democrats who are calling for fair maps. It's Iowans who are calling for fair maps, House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst of Windsor Heights said Thursday. That's who wants this. That's who deserves this, unquote. However, the ultimate decision whether the process remains nonpartisan will be up to Republicans, who have the legislative majority, Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls of Coralville told reporters during a virtual news conference. Based on the 2020 census, new boundaries will be drawn for 50 Iowa Senate and 100 Iowa House districts, as well as 4 U.S. House districts based on criteria established in the U.S. and Iowa constitutions and state law. The goal, according to the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency, which will draw the maps, is to make the districts as close to equal in populations as possible. Any deviation greater than 1% must be justified by the legislature. Republicans say they're not planning to change that law that puts the process of drawing the boundaries in the hands of the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. Quote, I look forward to following the nationally recognized nonpartisan process established in Iowa Code Chapter 42 to create congressional and legislative districts for the next decade, unquote. Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, Republican from Ankeny, said about the process. Quote, that's good, Walls said, but he would prefer a stronger commitment from the GOP that they will not offer any partisan amendments to our process. That hasn't happened yet, so I'm still concerned. The Legislative Services Agency plans to release the first map by September 16th. The Temporary Redistricting Advisory Commission has 2 weeks from then to gather public input before recommending a plan to the legislature, which must wait 3 days before taking an up or down vote on it. The commission has scheduled 3 virtual hearings. If lawmakers approve the first plan, it will go to the governor for her signature. If rejected, the Legislative Services Agency will draw another map that again is subject to a yes or no vote without any changes. If rejected, the agency draws a third that can be amended by lawmakers. What's unknown, Walls said, is what role the Iowa Supreme Court will play. Because of census delays, the current timeline does not comply with the constitutional requirement for the legislature to approve a plan by September 1st, and for the plan to be enacted by September 15th. After that, the Iowa Constitution shifts redistricting to the court. In April, the court issued a statement saying it tentatively plans to meet its constitutional responsibility by implementing a process which permits, to the extent possible, the redistricting framework presently set forth in Iowa Code Chapter 42 to proceed after September 15th. Quote, there's not a lot of clarity around that, in part, because the court has not really laid out their view or vision of how this is going to proceed under their authority, he said. Walls expected the court to allow the legislature to approve a plan in October special session, but we don't know that for sure. Comments may be submitted by the public online until the conclusion of the last hearing. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Friday, September 3rd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Alma Esther Kalloud. A celebration of life for Alma Esther Kalloud will be held Sunday, September 5th, 2021, at 1:30 p.m. in Kraus Phillips Funeral Home in Tama, with Pastor James Perry officiating. Interment will follow at National Cemetery in rural Vining. Alma was born May 26, 1928, to Otto and Vera, maiden name Sevchik, Vlasic, on the family farm west of Cloutier, Iowa. She graduated from Cloutier High School in 1947. On September 16, 1947, she married Wilbert J. Kalloud. They established their home on the farm northeast of Cloutier, where she lived the remainder of her life. Alma passed away April 27, 2020, while in the care of Unity Point Health Hospice in Waterloo, Iowa. Alma loved to cook and bake and was employed in the dietary department of Sunrise Hill Nursing Home, Traer, Iowa, for 35 years. She loved to dance, travel, do puzzles, and word search books, a page every day, and collecting anything owl-related. Alma loved the simple things in life, growing flowers, counting the baby calves in the pasture each day, enjoying the beauty of her mown lawn, and shaking a fist at the rabbits eating her plants. She relished the accomplishments of each of her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and came to be known as Granny C to a wide circle of her family's friends. LaPorte City, Donald Joseph Nye, 63, of LaPorte City, died Wednesday, September 1st, 2021, at LaPorte City Specialty Care of Natural Causes. He was born on January 6th, 1958, in Waterloo, son of Louis M. and Hilda C., maiden name Zeiser, Nye. He attended Immaculate Conception and Jessup schools and graduated from LaPorte City High School in 1978. After high school, he worked at John Deere and Thriftway grocery store in LaPorte City until he became disabled. Don loved John Deere tractors and collecting toy tractors and machinery. He loved watching professional wrestling, baseball, basketball, and football. He especially loved the Iowa Hawkeyes. He loved going to tractor pulls. Don was a Catholic Order of Forester member for 50 years. Memorials are to Sacred Heart Catholic Church in LaPorte City, Muscular Dystrophy Association, or to the family. Mass of Christian burial will be 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, September 4th, 2021, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in LaPorte City. Visitation is 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. on Friday, September 3rd, 2021, at LaPorte City Funeral Home, with a rosary beginning at 4 o'clock p.m. Burial will be St. Mary's Cemetery in Gilbertville. Online condolences may be left at www.kernsfuneralservice.com. Dysert. Arlene May Snyder Kafka, age 90, of Dysert, passed away Wednesday, September 1st, 2021, at the Cedar Valley Hospice House in Waterloo. For anyone wishing to join Arlene's family at a celebration of life, please call area code 319-654-5014. Online condolences may be sent to the family at www.krause-phillips.com. Now here is the Capital Digest column. This is a roundup of legislative and capital news items of interest from Wednesday, September 1st, 2021. It begins with a photograph of the Iowa Capitol's Golden Dome. August was the first of the summer months to bring above normal precipitation to the state, providing significant relief to ongoing drought conditions, according to the latest water summary update. Average precipitation for August totaled 4.64 inches, or 0.51 inches above normal, with especially high precipitation occurring in northeast Iowa at the end of the month. Monthly precipitation totals ranged from 0.23 inches in Fairfield to 20.65 inches at Ionia, a Chickasaw County city of 300 in north-central Iowa, where 11.25 inches of that total fell over a 24-hour period ending Sunday. The downpour caused flooding along the Wapsipinicon and Turkey Rivers this week. Waterloo received 6.60 inches of rain during August, according to Iowa State University's Iowa Environmental Messenet. Despite the above normal rainfall for the month, statewide 2021 rainfall totals are more than 4 inches below normal for the year. Stream flow and oil moisture levels have improved over most of the state as well. Drought conditions, as reflected in U.S. Drought Monitor, have also improved. The area of extreme drought in Iowa has been eliminated, and the area of severe drought has been reduced to less than 13% of the state. Still, drought conditions persist in more than 70% of the state, though severity has been significantly reduced. August revenues. Iowa's August revenues were $119 million more, or nearly 16% higher than in August 2020. But the Legislative Services Agency said that was because the second quarter ended on the last weekend in July, which pushed tax payments into August. personal income taxes received was up $452 million, or 9.6% from the previous August. Sales tax receipts increased nearly $393 million, or 16.9%. Corporate income taxes were down $4.2 million, or 26.1%. And other tax receipts dipped $700,000, or 0.2%, to almost $77 million. The state issued tax refunds of $31 million, a drop of $31.6 million from August 2020, and school infrastructure refunds totaled $51 million, up nearly $5 million compared to last August. COVID's cost: the preventable hospitalizations of unvaccinated people for COVID-19 cost an estimated $2.3 billion in June and July, according to a report from the nonpartisan Peterson Center on Healthcare and Kaiser Family Foundation, which Iowa State Auditor Rob Sand highlighted in a news release. According to the national report, 98.3% of the 185,000 adults hospitalized with a confirmed case of COVID-19 in June and July were unvaccinated. Of those hospitalizations, 113,000 were deemed preventable, according to the report. The organizations calculated the average cost of a COVID hospitalization at $20,000, producing the $2.3 billion total price tag. Quote, any hospitalization due to a serious illness is difficult for the patient and their families. It's especially disheartening when the hospitalization is almost entirely preventable, Sand said in a news release. Quote, we are all paying for these preventable hospitalizations, whether it be in the form of premiums to private insurers or costs to taxpayer-funded public programs, he said. Please don't add to others' expenses. Get the vaccine. Most importantly, it saves lives, but it also saves money, unquote. Just 49% of all Iowans are fully vaccinated, 58% of Iowans over age 12, according to the most recent state public health data. Iowa Diligent on Tobacco. An arbitration panel has ruled unanimously that Iowa diligently enforced state laws against tobacco companies that did not sign the Master Settlement Agreement in 1998 between tobacco companies and 46 states, including Iowa, which was estimated to encompass more than $206 billion in the first 25 years. The panel endorsed previous findings that Iowa exemplified a settling state, continuously and persistently enforcing the state's tobacco laws, Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller said in a news release. The panel found that Iowa's efforts were not static, but reflected a recognition based on experience that it could improve enforcement by refining its efforts and implementing enhanced enforcement tools to achieve greater results, unquote. The decision by the panel is a significant legal victory for the state in a years-long dispute with major tobacco companies that have withheld a significant portion of their 2004 settlement payments to the states and territories covered by the Master Settlement Agreement, Miller said. The tobacco manufacturers pay billions annually to participating states in exchange for the states agreeing not to sue for health-related damages to citizens. While today's ruling is a victory for Iowa and other states, Miller noted that this arbitration focused on the 2004 sales year and that tobacco companies could launch further legal challenges for subsequent years. Since 1999, when tobacco companies sent their first payments to the states, Iowa has received $1.36 billion in payments. This year, tobacco companies transferred $52.9 million to the state treasury in their annual payment. Justices on the road. The Iowa Supreme Court has scheduled oral arguments in Oskaloosa, Iowa City, and Des Moines during its 2021-22 term that runs from now until June 30th. The Supreme Court schedules evening oral argument sessions around the state for citizens who wish to attend a session but are unable to attend sessions in Des Moines. The court will hear arguments at Oskaloosa High School on September 23rd. the University of Iowa College of Law on October 8th, and Drake University Law School on March 31st. Seating is limited at the University of Iowa and Drake. The court's new term also marks the 8th year the Supreme Court will live stream and archive its oral arguments on the Iowa Court's YouTube channel. The court's complete oral argument calendar for its 2021-22 term can be found at iowacourts.gov. Iowan charged in January 6th riot back in jail for internet use. Story filed by Ryan J. Foley of the Associated Press. Iowa City. A federal judge on Thursday ordered a prominent participation on the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol to return to jail after he was caught accessing the internet to watch false conspiracy theories about the presidential election. U.S. District Judge Timothy Kelly said that Doug Jensen, 42, of Des Moines, Iowa, had violated the strict conditions that were set when he was released from jail on July 13th, including prohibitions on accessing the internet and using a cell phone. Kelly ordered marshals at the federal courthouse in Des Moines, where Jensen attended Thursday's hearing, to immediately take him into custody as he awaits trial. Prosecutors had moved to revoke Jensen's pretrial release August 19th, days after a federal officer found Jensen in his garage using an iPhone to watch news from Rumble, a streaming platform popular with conservatives. Jensen acknowledged he had earlier watched 2 days of the cyber symposium sponsored by MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell, an ally of former President Donald Trump, who used the event to push false theories that the presidential election's outcome was changed by Chinese hackers. Kelly noted that he had released Jensen from jail July 13th, after Jensen claimed he had an awakening behind bars and realized the QAnon conspiracy theory to which he adhered was a pack of lies. The judge said he put in place the strict conditions, including the internet ban, because Jensen had previously spent years following online conspiracies and acknowledged he had become a true believer and a digital soldier. Kelly said it was significant that Jensen's violations were caught during the first unannounced visit to his home by pretrial service officers. Quote, "It's now clear that he has not experienced a transformation and that he continues to seek out those conspiracy theories that led to his dangerous conduct on January 6th, Kelly said. Quote, "I don't see any reason to believe that he has had the wake-up call that he needs," unquote. Kelly said it was unlikely that Jensen would be able to follow any other conditions of release, barring internet use, and that he had lost confidence in Jensen's wife to serve as the third-party custodian. Prosecutors contended that she had facilitated his violations by leaving the phone on when she left for work. Jensen's attorney, Christopher Davis, had asked the court to give his client another chance, likening Jensen's internet use to an addiction. He argued that Jensen had complied with other release conditions, including staying home on electronic monitoring and avoiding drug use, and that his violations in no way endangered public safety. He said his client acknowledged the violations, but said that it was Orwellian for the government to seek to jail a man who was sitting in his garage listening to the news. Jensen was among the first people to enter the Capitol during the January 6th attack, crawling through a broken window. On Thursday, prosecutors cited new video evidence to claim he was also among the last to leave over an hour later, scuffling with officers on his way out. He told investigators he positioned himself as one of the riot leaders because he was wearing a shirt promoting QAnon, and he wanted the theory to get credit. Jensen was widely photographed during the attack. Jensen had a knife in his pocket when he led a crowd of people toward Capitol Police Officer Eugene Goodman, who was by himself and had only a baton. The crowd chased Goodman up a flight of stairs toward the Senate chamber as Jensen ignored Goodman's orders to stop and put his hands up. Amy Rivers filed this next story. Hart endorsed for fourth term as mayor by the collective PAC. Waterloo, not to be outdone by a recent endorsement of his rival, the current Waterloo mayor was endorsed Thursday by a National Political Action Committee. The collective PAC, the nation's largest political action committee, dedicated to increasing Black political engagement, representation, and power across all levels of government, announced Thursday it is endorsing a fourth term in office for Mayor Quentin Hart. Quote, Mayor Hart is committed to collaborating with residents and businesses to expand Waterloo's economy through the completion of Highway 63. Additionally, he is an advocate for accessible broadband throughout the city. The PAC's founders, Quentin James and Stephanie Brown James, said in a release, Mayor Hart is passionate about creating bridges across the city to unite residents and advance the community, unquote. The collective PAC is pleased to announce Mayor Hart's progressive legacy, the founders added. Under his leadership, Waterloo is prospering and progressing forward, unquote. According to the collective's website, the PAC, which also endorsed Amara Andrews for mayor of Cedar Rapids, is specifically looking to improve our democracy by addressing the underrepresentation of African Americans in public office. Hart could not be immediately reached for comment on the endorsement. The endorsement comes just days after a local pro-law enforcement PAC, Cedar Valley Backs the Blue, endorsed Hart's rival for the mayoral race, City Councilor Margaret Klein. Let's read stories from the sports page now. Under college football, Panthers ready for challenge at number 7 Iowa State. Stories filed by Craig Sesker. Cedar Falls. The Northern Iowa Panthers have spent the entire preseason hearing about the lofty expectations their Week 1 football opponent has. The Iowa State Cyclones have a top 10 national ranking, multiple preseason All-Americans, and a legitimate Heisman Trophy candidate. But UNI also has its share of top-caliber players and plenty of high expectations of its own. That should make for an intriguing matchup when the Panthers and Cyclones square off Saturday afternoon in front of a sellout crowd of 61,500 fans at Jack Trice Stadium in Ames. Kickoff is set for 3:30 p.m., with the game being broadcast on ESPN+. Quote, we just need to go in there and enjoy it, UNI coach Mark Farley said. Quote, it's been a long time since we've seen an environment like this. It's going to be fun. We just have to focus on the task at hand and not get caught up in everything. We just have to embrace it and play our game, unquote. If Saturday's game resembles their last matchup, fans are in for an entertaining contest. The Cyclones outlasted the Panthers 29-26 in triple overtime 2 years ago in Ames, but the odds makers see it much differently. Iowa State is favored by more than 4 touchdowns against Northern Iowa. Quote, they are the same players, but they are better, Farley said of Iowa State. They're more experienced, and they've had a lot of success. Their defense is excellent. Their offense is obviously very good, but they're very good on defense as well, unquote. Iowa State was ranked number 7 nationally in NCAA Division I, while Northern Iowa is number 21 in the FCS. For Northern Iowa, it will be the first time in nearly 2 years it has played a game in the fall. Quote, it's great finally having a fall game, Farley said. It's exciting to be playing in big-time college environment and atmosphere again. It's awesome to have an opportunity to play in a setting like that, unquote. UNI's 2020 fall season was postponed until the spring of 2021 because of COVID issues. The Panthers finished 3-4 earlier in the calendar year while playing an abbreviated schedule. When Northern Iowa takes the field Saturday, it will only have been 147 days since it last played in a game. The Panthers are looking for more production from an offense led by 2-year starter Will McIlvaine at quarterback, NFL prospect Trevor Penning at left tackle, and all-league performer Isaiah Weston, at wide receiver. Quote, I'm a huge Will McElvain fan, ISU coach Mac Campbell said. When I watch Will play, he's an elite competitor. You watch how he plays every single play. He's playing to win every single play, unquote. Northern Iowa will face an ISU offense anchored by standout linebacker Mike Rose, a preseason All-American. UNI's strength is defensively. The Panthers allowed just 15 points per game during the spring schedule. They are led by tackle Jared Brinkman, the reigning conference defensive player of the year. All-conference linebacker Spencer Cuvillier and all-league defensive back Omer Brown will also play key roles on the loaded Northern Iowa defense. Quote, the thing that impresses me the most is how well they're coached, Campbell said. Quote, they do so many different things defensively. They're always in the right place when they're supposed to be there. To be able to be so multiple, that's the thing that impresses me as much as anything, unquote. UNI will face a huge challenge when it tries to slow down a dynamic Cyclone offense that includes Heisman Trophy candidate Breece Hall at the running back and all-conference selection Brock Purdy at quarterback. Quote, they have a very explosive offense with a lot of weapons, Farley said. It will be a great challenge for our guys, but they're ready for it. These are the games that you want to play in, unquote. UNI returns numerous players from the team that suffered a heartbreaking setback 2 years ago at Iowa State. Quote, we have the opportunity to play the number 7 ranked team in the nation, Weston said. How exciting is that? We have to be on our A game to compete with guys like that, unquote. Now this next story has the opposite perspective. Iowa State wants to avoid first game issues against UNI, filed by Ben Visser, a sports correspondent. Ames, it's no secret that early season games have been a bugaboo for coach Matt Campbell. His Iowa State teams are 7-11 in August and September games since he took over. He's 28-17 games after September. He knows his Cyclone teams have had their troubles early in the seasons and is something he believes he's successfully addressed ahead of number 7 Iowa State's season opener against Northern Iowa on Saturday at 3:30 in Jack Trice Stadium. Last season's opening loss to Louisiana had extenuating circumstances, like a worldwide pandemic, and the Cyclones weren't even sure if they were going to play the game a week and a half before it was played. Still, Campbell didn't make excuses. Quote, I remember thinking during the third quarter last season, what an awkward environment, Campbell said. I felt I did a poor job of preparing the team for what was going to be, because I didn't know what it was going to be or how it was going to feel. But we adapted and we grew as the season went, unquote. Even giving Iowa State the benefit of the doubt and disregarding the Louisiana game, 2 seasons ago, UNI pushed Iowa State to the brink in a triple overtime game. UNI also handed Campbell his first loss as Iowa State's coach in his first game. Quote, at the end of the day, the facts are the facts, Campbell said of his team's early season struggles. It's been an area for us that I think we've kind of tried to look at from a holistic approach in saying, man, where do we have to get better? Quote, what I think we're really looking at is, man, you get 12 guaranteed opportunities in college football. How, from the head coach's perspective, do you put a calendar together, and how do you put a process together that allows your football team to be their best in those 12 guaranteed opportunities, unquote. That process began with revamping fall camp. In years past, Iowa State's first team offense went against its scout team defense, and the first team defense went against the scout team offense. This fall, it was first team offense versus first team defense. The players embraced the change. Quarterback Brock Purdy loved going against linebacker Mike Rose for the entire fall. Purdy said he'd make an adjustment at the line. Rose would make an adjustment to the adjustment, and the two would play a little chess on the football field. The other change for fall camp that Purdy felt was the offense felt like it had an identity. Two seasons ago, Iowa State was trying to figure out who its running back would be, and three seasons ago, it was trying to figure out the quarterback. Now, they know exactly who they are. Quote, having a really good fall camp from beginning to end is really critical going into the first game, Purdy said. Years past, not going to lie, I felt like we were a roller coaster as an offense during fall camp. Then when we get to that first game, it's like, shoot, we're still trying to figure out who we are as offense and who can do what. Now we understand who can do what, so I think it'll be big in terms of having early success, unquote. And Purdy liked what he saw during fall camp. Quote, this was the best fall camp we've had yet, Purdy said. As far as the maturity, leadership, everybody knows what to expect. Before, it was just certain guys trying to get the rest of them going. Now, everyone is stepping up, and we have so many leaders that sometimes I'm like, dang, I have to take a step back and let someone else step up and lead and learn to do that stuff. That's a good thing. Quote, this has been the best fall camp as far as offense goes, and the defense looks great as well. We were doing two-minute drills, and we were just grinding away. Defense was making plays. Offense was making plays, and I was like, wow, we have so much maturity and talent across the board with so much depth. I love where we're at, unquote. Even with a well-prepared team and a smooth fall camp, Campbell loves saying, quote, you really don't know who you are until the lights come on, unquote. Inevitably, an early season mistake will be made. It'll be up to the Cyclones to recover from it and move past it. Quote, that's the thing about the first game in every football season. You better be ready to understand what some of those problems and challenges are, and you better be able to handle it, Campbell said, especially against a really talented opponent with a really veteran coach that plays really good against us, like you and I, unquote. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Friday, September 3rd. I'm your reader, Bob Young. Thank you so much for joining us today.